22-2180, State v. John R. Maloney. Arguing for the defendant is Attorney Lou A. Wasserman. Mr. Wasserman.
May it please the Court. Good afternoon. Good afternoon to everybody. If I might, I'd like to take just a moment. I want to thank somebody, too. And that's Attorney Sylvia Wasserman, my aunt. Been gone about a year now. A 1939 graduate of Northwestern University Law School, one of two women, the only one who ever practiced. I always looked up to her. I guess I still do. I want to thank her. I also want to say I'm uncomfortable with this height disparity.
So are we.
Excuse us as we stand.
Well, I was hoping that the chief could maybe sit way up there at least, so one of us.
How is the mic? Is anyone having?
We need to have it.
A little more volume.
A little more volume.
Right,
yes.
Is that better?
That's fine, yes.
Thank you. This case, as was pointed out, you weren't in the courtroom, by Attorney Mary Wolfe. When I listened to her, I was grateful. It was obvious at least somebody had read my briefs. I could tell that. But it does involve ineffective assistance of counsel, and that's sort of the overlaying or overlying analysis that is going to dictate the result in this case. And I want to address that issue, but even before that, there's something else that I'd like to address, and that's this. Some factual findings that were made at the trial court level. Because if I can't get beyond those factual findings, which I believe to be clearly erroneous, then this will be a wonderful academic discussion, but it won't benefit my client. So there are two. The one that I think is the most important factual finding made by the trial court and reiterated by the Court of Appeals in the For What It's Worth category is that when Tracy Helen Brown was taping John Maloney, she was doing so to help him, exonerate him, exculpate him, however you want to phrase it. Nothing, indeed, in reality, could be farther from the truth.
Well, does that make a difference?
It does. It especially makes a difference in the analysis as to whether or not she was committing an other injurious act under 968.31 sub 2 sub C. Obviously, Your Honor, if you believe she was trying to help him, then she's obviously not trying to injure him. So it's very important for that analysis, but I also think it's important for
factually, let me just ask, factually, she was a volunteer. Is that in dispute?
Well, let me put it this way. I don't think she was dragged kicking or screaming into that conference on June 8th of 1998.
She was represented by counsel.
But she only became a volunteer when she received a grant of immunity from Assistant United States Attorney Stephen Biskupic, the brother of the other special prosecutor. Now, if that makes her a volunteer, okay. But I don't really think that that's all of the story. But it's also important to the analysis as to whether or not there was an egregious ethical violation that was occurring here. It's not enough for me to convince you that Joe Paulus committed an ethical violation. That alone would not be enough. It might be enough to get him disbarred, but it's not enough to help John Maloney. I have to convince you, and the Court of Appeals and Judge Nasi was not convinced, so I have one more opportunity, that it was an egregious ethical violation. So, Sandy Maloney died on February 10 of 1998. Approximately 3 days later, on February 13, Tracy Helen Brown was interviewed by two City of Green Bay detectives, Broadhagen and Molitor. They wrote reports of that interview, one of which was read in its entirety in the trial that was held in February of 1999. Several months later, on June 8 of 1998, Ms. Hellebrand and her attorney, Special Prosecutor Paulus, Agent Skolinski, Agam, an IRS agent, and by telephone, at least during part of the meeting, the United States Attorney's Office by Steve Biskupic, held a meeting in Mr. Cohn's office in Milwaukee. Parenthetically, to be able to get a prosecutor to come down to a different city to meet is It's unusual, but that's what they did. They didn't go up to Green Bay or go up to Oshkosh or Appleton. They all came down to Milwaukee. The first thing that happened in the course of the meeting was that Ms. Helen Brown received a grant of immunity from the Assistant United States Attorney Stephen Biskupic. Now, why is that of interest? By itself, it may not be very important, but we have to remember that Joe Paulus, the special prosecutor, is in the room and is privy to the discussions, and in my view, by his very presence, puts the imprimatur of the state upon that immunity agreement. Additionally, beyond that, it ought to be quite clear that whether or not Ms. Helen Brand lived up to the terms of her immunity agreement was something that was going to be kept tabs of by who? Joe Paulus. Now, apparently during the course of the meeting, according to affidavits filed months later in December of 1998 by Skrolinski and by Paulus, during the course of this meeting, Tracy Helen Brand says that when she met with Broadhagen and Molitor back in February, that she volunteered to wear a wire to exculpate Maloney. Well, when the reports of that meeting are read, and they're part of the discovery that trial counsel had, there's no mention of that whatsoever. When the report is read in at trial, there's no mention of her telling the Green Bay detectives that she would wear a wire to exculpate Maloney. Indeed, it's quite clear from the reports that trial counsel had, and even from the testimony at trial that relate back to June 8th of 1998, to the limited extent that it does, that Helen Brown was only going to tape Maloney basically to save her own skin. She was not taping John Maloney to help out John Maloney. And you know,
How was she implicated? What was her skin? How was her skin implicated?
She was seeking immunity and received immunity for lying on her application to become an IRS agent and for other problems that she had created in the scope of her capacity as an IRS investigating agent. And by that, I mean, she was not...
to do with this case.
No, it did not. It did not. But in order to make those problems go away, she agreed, and it's quite clear from the notes that have been supplied to this court and were supplied to trial counsel, that the whole purpose of the June 8th meeting is to bring her on board to get a confession from John Maloney, not to help him out, to get a confession.
And just let me interrupt here. As I understand it, in May, Maloney's attorney was Boyle. In other words, he had come aboard. I'm talking about in May of 98.
Approximately May 12th,
right,
at the latest.
That's correct.
Yes.
And so at the time that this went on, that you're discussing, that there was no charge yet. He was only noted to be a suspect in the discussions between Boyle and Paulus. Correct?
Well, indeed, Your Honor, he was the only suspect.
Well,
there was none
okay.
other.
Well, and that was brought out at trial, I mean, in some ways. But what impact, I'm just going to ask you, what impact, saying everything that you're saying about the unethical conduct and the fact that Paulus was involved, what case do you refer to that would lead this court to make a finding that evidence should not come into a trial?
Well, obviously, I think there are two lead cases that we can look at.
Yeah.
One is clearly the what I call the Hamad line of cases. And, of course, there's a state case, and it's cited in the brief. I can't remember the exact site, State versus Miller from Minnesota, that also makes that point. I'm the first one to admit that there are essentially two lines of thought on this issue in this country. There's one line of thought that says that what Joe Paulus did is authorized by law. And there's another line of thought represented by the Hamad line of cases, which, by the way, it was cited favorably in the ethics, formal ethics opinions issued by the State Bar of Wisconsin. Judge Nazi said that they were not binding but influential. They didn't influence Mr. Paulus, unfortunately, or any of the other lawyers that were involved in the case. But clearly there are two lines of cases. Here's why, factually, I think that this court should follow and adopt, if you will, the holding, if you will, of the ethics opinion, and that's this. In my view, what Joe Paulus did was not only unethical, but it was immoral and illegal. In the Hamad case, it was the issuance of a single forged subpoena to give a confidential informant to wave in front of the target to get him to talk. One incident, one time. Every single case cited by Mr. O'Brien is something along those lines. A single attempt, a single taping, a single incident. In this case, we have the invasion of two lawyer-client relationships by Paulus and Helen Brand, and even by Skrilinski to an extent. Two, you may remember that as of June 19, 1998, Mr. Maloney was a party to an action, and that was the police disciplinary proceeding. Statutory basis not only for that proceeding, but for his retaining, I use the term broadly, attorney Perrins. And you may recall from the documents that I've submitted that there was some conversation between Helen Brand and Paulus about whether or not she should cooperate with attorney Perrins, and he told her through Agent Skrilinski quite clearly, stay away from attorney Perrins until you get a confession from Maloney.
Perrins represented the police union, right?
Yes.
And of course, your client, I think, talked to Perrins also in some capacity, as I recall. That may be a...
Well, the precise subject of their talks, of course, aren't of record, and I wouldn't go into it, I guess, even if I knew them, but yes. What was occurring at the time was that attorney Perrins was attempting to prepare for the, if you will, hearing that was about to be held. He attempted to call Helen Brand, who by that time was in Las Vegas. Instead of calling him back, she called Skrilinski. He said, hold on, I'll call Paulus. And then he got back to her. He says, Paulus says, don't contact Perrins until you get a confession from Maloney. There also was at least one time in the reports alone that indicated that Helen Brand and her attorney were concerned that Maloney was indeed consulting with Boyle about the very issues that Helen Brand was trying to get him to talk about.
Mr. Wasserman,
yes, Your Honor.
When I read your brief and as I've listened to your oral argument, I keep having a question, and that's whether or not you're asking that we should look at all of these things together and determine that your client should get a new trial in the interest of justice. Is that where you're going with both your argument in your brief and your argument here this afternoon?
I've always thought that this court thought that that was sort of a last resort. If that is the basis that this court chooses to act on, obviously that's something for this court's discretion. I certainly would not counsel against that, but no, the thrust of my argument is this. Everything that I have explained was within the knowledge, or should have been within the knowledge, of Mr. Maloney's trial counsel. I have to go back to the fact that this is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And so what I have to do is demonstrate that somehow that performance, nonetheless, despite all these, was deficient and therefore prejudicial. Everything I've explained, they knew and did not pursue. They pursued an entirely different line. I'm going to give Attorney Boyle credit for doing the right thing in this regard. He repeatedly complained throughout the transcripts and throughout the motions, complained about Paulus' conduct in this regard. In other words, in talking to his client behind his back, it's in virtually every motion that he filed. The problem is he never supplied any citation to authority whatsoever. None. At the Mockner hearing, Attorney Bridget Boyle said, well, we didn't do that because of the Ward case out of Illinois. Your Honors, the Ward case out of Illinois is in the Hamad line of cases. It supports the claim that they decided not to bring based on the holding in that case. At the very least, there was clearly sufficient precedent at various levels for them to formulate their motion. And then in the worst-case scenario, it would have been before you on direct appeal instead of in the context of a 97406 motion, and you would have decided this issue years and years ago.
You say that Mr. Boyle complained about Paulus's conduct to the judge, to the jury, to
not,
whom?
Well, in all the pretrial proceedings, he did. And there was some grousing about it during the context of the trial, but it was never formulated into a precise complaint. But there was an in-chambers conference in December, and it's noted in the transcripts, and it's noted in the filings that the state made thereafter that Attorney Boyle had repeatedly complained about the conduct of the special prosecutor. Again, I think he should have, but failed to supply any citation to authority. That is why when Judge Nasi in late January ruled on the motions to suppress the statements, he treated it solely as a Miranda issue, a sort of permutated Miranda issue, never at all dealt with Mr. Boyle's complaints about Mr. Paulus because it was a completely undeveloped argument. All right, there's the prejudice prong as far as I'm concerned. The deficient performance prong.
You're not going to argue, well, maybe you will, that he should have been given a Miranda warning before he talked to Ms. Hillebrand.
No, of course not. No, Your Honor.
Or that Miranda was violated here.
No, it wasn't Miranda that was violated.
He was not in custody.
He was not in custody.
But your position is he had a lawyer, and yet the opposition was talking to him.
It's a little more complicated or perhaps subtle than that, but yes, that's it. That Rule 4.2 was violated. I have also...
He's a suspect, probably, but he's not been charged, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But he is the only suspect. They're not looking at anybody else at this point.
But if you the court should say, anytime you got a suspect who might or might not have a lawyer generally or might have a lawyer specifically for the case, that you can't put a wire on somebody to talk to him, that really would stifle law enforcement, wouldn't it?
Let me tell you what I think ought to be the court's concerns. I'm going to agree with you, but just give me a moment to tell you the parameters of that. If there are ongoing crimes that the state is investigating, that might warrant a closer look at whether or not the rule's been violated. If we're talking about an investigation into terrorism or major drug dealing involving multiple defendants, I would understand why that might give this court pause to sort of automatically cut off that type of investigation. It certainly would not be outlandish or inappropriate or stymie the investigation to require prosecutors to do what they do when they need a warrant, is to run it by a magistrate. Some magistrates say, look, we need to invade the attorney-client relationship by talking to this guy outside the presence of his lawyer. Here's why. Otherwise, prosecutors have virtually unlimited and unfettered ability to contact represented defendants. And by the way, there were many contacts between Attorney Boyle and Joe Paulus even before the June 8th meeting. So I think it would be completely unfair to say and untrue to say that Maloney just retained Attorney Boyle to avoid being investigated. That was not the case. There were ongoing discussions of some substance.
But that is standard. Obviously, the prosecutor is talking to defense counsel. That's standard behavior, isn't it? I mean, obviously, they're discussing the case. I mean, if you want some rule to say, well, that would be inappropriate, as a trial judge of 13 years, that's just standard behavior. And there is no rule that I know of, unless you can point out to one that would say that is unethical, that part of it.
Well, Your Honor, all I can say is this. When we defense counsel are retained, even before charges, the first thing we do is try to hunt down the prosecutor. We might want to do a negotiated issuance. There's a thousand things that we want to do. The last thing we want to do, though, is go to that prosecutor, sit down with him and talk to him, and when we leave the room, he turns around and tells one of his agents to, hey, go talk to this guy's client. That we don't want. and it's unethical in my view. Rule 4.2 clearly prohibits it. And by the way, if the special prosecutor and
Mr.
even
Mr. Watson, wasn't District Attorney Robert Zaff disciplined for violating the predecessor rule 20:38(1) for having conversation with a represented client?
Yes, and there have been two prosecutors that, in my review of Supreme Court decisions, and it may not be exclusive, have been disciplined for having that kind of contact with represented individuals. Incidentally, and I know it's apples and oranges, but courts, federal, state, have never hesitated to invoke Rule 4.2 in the civil context, where lawyers have gone behind the backs of lawyers on the other side and contacted their clients.
Well, that's the issue, though, that you're talking about, that the prosecutor went behind and talked to the client. That's the main concern under the Supreme Court rule that you're asking us to look at. The question I have, what cases you have, the Hammond line of cases, is there anything else in Wisconsin where a lawyer has been disciplined but that the evidence has been kept out of the case?
Well, the lawyer has been disciplined and the evidence has been kept
out
of the
case.
Well,
this is what you're talking about, an ethical violation.
Yes. No, why should we do this? Why should we take the next step?
And well, I'm just asking about what case you can cite to us. The state says that there are few, if any.
Well, that's true. The reason I'm asking you to do this is not because there's precedent in Wisconsin. There isn't on point. Well, there's one federal case from Judge Edelman, the Acosta case, that clearly indicates that the responsibilities of a prosecutor attach pre-indictment, interpreting Wisconsin's rules. But it's because, again, this is my review. I'm going to advocate for my client here. This is the worst case, what this investigation behind Attorney Boyle's back did. This is the worst case scenario of any that I have read. That the repeated attempts, the salacious attempts, the idea that in fact they were, it seems to me, attempting to actually learn what Maloney was telling Boyle, telling them to make sure that you don't talk to attorney parents, make sure you get that confession first, which of course would have made talking to attorney parents completely meaningless at that point. It was repeated, rapacious attempts to go behind Mr. Maloney's counsel. I do not understand why Maloney's counsel did not make that argument. I have a red light.
Mr. Wasserman, I've got a question, if I might, and it's something that concerns me. Within the last several days, the members of the court received from the Assistant Attorney General a copy of the transcript from a CBS program, 48 Hours. Do you have any objection to the members of the court considering that transcript?
May I address that? My time's almost up, but let me address that. This is what I think of the importance of that, and that's this. Judge Nasi found, with regard to my third argument, about Maloney's counsel repeatedly asking Agent Skorlinski if he thought Maloney was lying when he denied involvement. The trial court found, and the Court of Appeals also found, that that was a reasonable strategy. Well, that's how you show that Agent Skorlinski was biased. Look at page 4 of that filing, Your Honor, and you'll see it would have been there's a much, much better way to, if you will, attack that investigation, and that is bring up all that evidence that both the state and Mr. Boyle knew about and didn't bring into the court. If the court wants to look at what I think is really important about that filing, and I guess I'm going to thank Mr. O'Brien because it's kind of an unusual authority, but fine, it's in, so let's address it. Yes, that to me is what is really significant about that, because it shows, yes, there really was a much better way other than asking the state's lead investigator if he thought your client was a liar over and over and over, oh, I'm sorry, but then asking him if he thought he was telling the truth when he said he was at the house. I do not believe, by the way, that if we're going to talk about waiver of the Hazeltine rule, as the Court of Appeals did, that there's any record indicating that there was any kind of waiver of that rule whatsoever.
Your response to Justice Crooks, yes?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
You have pinned this argument on the ethics violation of the prosecutor. And Justice Wilcox says it's not unusual for a prosecutor, before a defendant is charged, to, if not directly, indirectly through the police, to question a suspect. So the ramifications of this case might be very widespread. All of these assumptions are true. And I'm wondering if this case would be brought but for the fact that Mr. Paulus had his own problems, ultimately with the IRS, sort of like Ms. Hillebrand apparently, and that in the investigations, it appears as if Mr. Paulus did not abide by the best and required practices of a prosecutor. He might have falsified evidence or not made disclosures, etc. And so what part does this general conduct of Mr. Paulus affect this case? And there's been an investigation, right?
Yes, may I? My time
yes,
is...
Yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. I'm asking that you find that his conduct was egregious. Not every conduct that a prosecutor will have with a represented defendant will rise to that level. Those we need not be concerned about, that's for another day, or not at all. But in this case, because it was an egregious violation of that rule, that's why this case went forward. If Joe Paulus was still there practicing law with Jerry Boyle, I'd still be here making the same argument. My time is up, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserman. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. O'Brien is having a long day. He represented the state in the prior case and often represents the state and appears here. And thank you for coming, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Mr. O'Brien, I hate to jump on this, but
But he will.
But I will. Well, I think Justice Crooks's question to your opposing counsel on, you know, we received this letter from, I think, your supervisor, Attorney General Weber, as to the 48-hour transcript. And it's unusual because this is like sending us a clippings out of the newspaper. And then there's some comment in the letter as to what this particular assistant district attorney had to say about the case. What do you want us to do with that? What do you expect us to do?
It's strictly for informational purposes,
okay.
Because obviously this is something that's a matter of public knowledge, public record. It was aired. I didn't even know it was going to be on. I happened to leave the TV on after the Illinois-Arizona game ended, and I walked back into the room, and I almost fell to the floor. But the main purpose was not to take issue with or agree with or whatever with any most of what was said, except the concern over the comments by the prosecutor, and to make it clear that that does not represent the position of the state in this case. He had no involvement in this case, still does not, and it is directly contrary to the position that we have taken all along that Mr. Malone did receive a fair trial. And now, with that, I'll just launch into the argument, and you may be surprised to know that I agree 100% with Mr. Wasserman. His opening comment was that this is an ineffective assistance case, and when we get right down to it, that is what this is, nothing more nor nothing less. This court is to review this claim under the Strickland v. Washington two-prong test, deficient performance and prejudice, at which Mr. Wasserman must prove a reason that counsel performed efficiently, and if he succeeds in that, that there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome. Now, we have argued, and I think the law backs us up, that Mr. Wasserman has not crossed that first threshold with respect to any of his challenges to Mr. Boyle's representation. He failed to prove deficient performance. He insists that Attorney Boyle should have argued the point that there was a violation of SCR 24.2, that it requires suppression of evidence from a criminal trial, and that Mr. Boyle was not acting as a competent lawyer for failing to see that. Now, Mr. Boyle did challenge the admissibility of the Vegas videotapes on the grounds that there was a very closely related argument relating to right to counsel issues, but also a due process challenge, which is a fairly unusual challenge on the basis of outrageous government conduct in the way that the informant was used. That was an argument that was preserved. It was argued unsuccessfully at trial and again on the direct appeal. And I would suggest that that, of any of the arguments, might be the one that comes close to stating a colorable claim. The ethics violation argument, while it's a nice theory, simply does not have any law to back it up. First of all, as we've argued, 24.2 specifically states in unambiguous language that a lawyer cannot contact a party to a pending matter. Well, when this undercover investigation was going on, there was no pending criminal matter, and Mr. Maloney was not yet charged. Moreover, even if you get past that, Mr. Maloney has to show that this contact was not otherwise authorized by law, as expressly provided at 24.2. And again, the cases are legion for the proposition that criminal investigative activities, such as undercover information gathering at the pre-charging, non-custodial, pre-indictment phase, is authorized by law under the canons of ethics. And finally, even if you get past
the DA himself or herself or by the police or both,
I think the rule can be read broadly enough to even include the prosecutor. But that would be more in the nature of I think if you're getting into investigative activities, it's more likely going to involve people one or two steps below the prosecutor.
Oh, but they do check with the assistant.
Yes.
District attorney.
Oh, yes, and they did here. I mean,
sometimes the assistant DA checks with the assistant attorney general.
Sure. Yes, I mean,
it goes all the way up the line.
Yes, and there's certainly, in most investigations, there's going to be some awareness of an ongoing police activity on the part of the prosecutor. So I don't see anything in these rules that prohibit contact by the prosecutor directly. In this case, that was not what happened here. And in the run-of-the-mill case where you have an undercover informant, undercover police investigative activities, the prosecutor is acting more as a supervisor, maybe as a legal advisor, that sort of thing. And that type of activity, I maintain, is authorized by law under the no-contact rules. And
your position is there's no violation of the ethics code.
That's correct. And because Mr. Maloney was not yet a party to any pending criminal matter, and or because this sort of investigative activity is not is authorized by law.
Isn't your position, I'm going to take you a little further down the road, but not only if it's authorized or isn't authorized by law, that suppression would be a very unusual.
Yes.
I'm talking about the ethical violation is one thing, but suppression is clearly something that would not be used.
That's correct. That the cases, even the Hamad case, acknowledges that generally that is true, that suppression is not an available remedy, and that and most of the cases say unequivocally that suppression is not an available remedy for an ethics violation, that suppression is reserved for constitutional violations or in situations where a statute specifically authorizes suppression.
Our court has recognized reversal of a conviction, however, for ethics violation, has it not?
I'm not aware of that.
I would refer you to the case of State versus Russell, which is in volume 83, Wisconsin 1st, at page 330 in 1892 case, where the Wisconsin Supreme Court reversed a conviction because an attorney, the district attorney, represented to the defendant and brought in and employed a person to act as that defendant's lawyer. And the court really harped on the ethical improprieties of that in reversing the conviction. I would also refer to State versus Cervantes and State versus Ruiz, which sets forth the test for when the court should act when there are misconduct violations on the part of the prosecutors.
Well, the Ruiz case I'm familiar with, if I recall, this court upheld that conviction.
It did, but didn't it set forth a standard that should be followed by the court?
But and if I also recall, I believe the contacts in that case were after charging. Now, maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't believe there's any authority in Wisconsin for a pre-charging, pre-indictment, non-custodial situation. And if the Russell case, if a prosecutor had someone masquerading as a defense attorney, well, that would require a reversal in the interest of justice, if nothing else, and it would be a blatant due process violation, I would suggest.
The law should be different. What do you think, Mr. O'Brien?
If the law is different, then if I'm an international drug dealer, I'm going to send a letter to every prosecutor's office in this country saying I've retained so-and-so as my lawyer. You are hereby notified, and no longer will everyone ever be able to investigate me. And that's really the upshot of all this. We can throw names around here. Everybody knows who Joe Paulus is. I would suggest if we took his name out of this case and put in the names of the many wonderful prosecutors in this state, this case wouldn't even be here, because we are talking about, after all, an undercover investigation. And I don't think you can distinguish between acts of terrorism, drug dealing, or murder. They still warrant investigation. And undercover work is never clean. It's always got its seamy side. You are using people of questionable character to obtain information, but it's a necessary evil in the system to find the guilty and to exonerate the innocent. And to throw out one whole area of inquiry, one whole avenue of obtaining information because someone has retained a lawyer prior to the time that they're constitutionally entitled to one, I think is a step that is just not warranted here, and I don't think we've been shown anything that does justify it here. Have sanctions for people who violate the code of ethics. We have a specific procedure set up in the Supreme Court rules 2021 and 22 dealing with these things. People can lose their licenses. People can be reprimanded. But to then exclude the most damaging evidence from a criminal trial on the basis that someone contacted a client who was not yet constitutionally entitled to counsel, I just don't believe is a step that this court should be taking.
Is it your position, counsel, that suppression is not an available remedy for a violation of this ethics code?
Yes, that is my position.
Tell me, maybe I'm missing something in the Hamad case, but as I read part of it, so help me with this. At 8:39, the court said, on appeal, the government also claims that even if there was a violation of the disciplinary rule, exclusion is inappropriate to remedy an ethical breach, which you've just said is your position. The Hamad case goes on to state, we have not heretofore decided whether the suppression is warranted for a ethical code violation. We now hold that, in light of the underlying purposes of the professional responsibility code and the exclusionary rule, suppression may be ordered in the district court's discretion.
That's what they said they felt was warranted in exercising their supervisory authority over the district courts. And I guess that's what counsel is asking you to do here, is in addition to the OLR procedures already in place, he wants you to exercise your supervisory authority over the circuit courts to say, when in your discretion you feel like doing this, go ahead and suppress it if you think that there's an egregious violation. That's a pretty slippery slope, I would suggest.
One of the things that bothers me, and your opposing counsel started out with this and suggested that he can't get to, put words in his mouth, but maybe can't get to first base unless he deals with overcoming two factual findings made by the court. And one deals with the intent of the taping, that is, that she taped in order to exonerate the defendant. There is something bothersome to me that the facts indicate she asked for immunity. Most people who would be offering to be taping in order to assist their boyfriend to be exonerated wouldn't first ask for immunity.
Well, there's a first of all, we have to understand the timing here. That statement of hers, and this was in the June 98 affidavit meeting at her lawyer's office, where she said, she told the people at that meeting that she had told Green Bay police back in February that she thought he was innocent, and she was willing to even wear a wire to prove that he was innocent. And then even later on in another affidavit, she continues to insist on his innocence, and it's only in June where she realizes that maybe that's not the case, and that now, because of her concerns with the IRS, that if she's going to help the police at this point, she wants immunity. And these were, and I believe these are referred to, this conversation was referred to in the affidavits as well. There were no pending charges against her with the IRS. She was concerned about things that she had said that people either hadn't found out about it or had but hadn't done anything about yet. And she was concerned that that would come out. And I believe she was even concerned that Mr. Maloney might bring it to the attention of the authorities if she tried anything, and that she wanted to clear that all up before she cooperated. So again, this is the sort of thing that happens when you deal with informants and you deal with other people who are involved in unsavory activities, and you're trying to get information. Deals are made, and those sorts of things happen. The important thing is that there was no pending charge against her at that time, and it had nothing to do with this particular prosecution.
The time she wears the wire, does she think he's guilty, or does she think he's innocent? And is she trying to help him or not help him?
At the time they actually went through and right. did the, actually in Las Vegas it was the videotaping,
right.
not a wire.
Right.
At that time she's working with the police, believing
okay,
that.
So she doesn't think that she's going to exonerate him.
Not at that point. This is 5 months later. Yeah.
Is it correct or incorrect that Attorney Boyle, representing Maloney at the time, he knew that his client was going to go to, I think, the Lucky Strike Casino or something in Las Vegas, that he advised him not to go?
Boyle, all along from day one, representing Mr. Maloney, told him, as any good defense attorney would, don't talk to anybody about this case, especially stay away from Tracy Hellenbrand. Don't have anything to do with her. So what does he do? He invites himself out to Vegas to spend a weekend with her and engages in all sorts of activity with her. If we want to talk about rapacious and words like that, we're not talking about the common street criminal here. We're talking about, after all, someone who gives Miranda warnings for a living, someone who investigates for a living, who knows what police do to get information out of people, to get incriminating statements out of people. And he has a good lawyer telling him the things that he should already know, and he's ignoring them.
Didn't he also have some suspicion he was being taped out there? Didn't he try to search
yes.
the room and try to
yes.
find a bug? And
yes, in fact, the police removed several of the bugs because he got real close to finding a couple of them. And then he challenged her and asked her if there were bugs and that sort of thing. And then apparently after she left, he again snooped around looking for things. So, yeah, he was suspicious. But by all accounts, didn't find anything, and so apparently then felt free to continue on and, you know, saying things and doing things that you probably shouldn't have been doing. Yeah,
but in this record, this videotape, what exactly was the inculpatory statement? I'm sort of unclear, even after reading all of the briefs, as to what exactly. There were 6.5 hours of taping. And was that all used in the trial? Was it cut up?
There was a tape. Not every second of the tape was used. It couldn't be. There were just way too many hours. So there was a condensed form, and there was a transcript also presented to the jury. There was never an inculpatory open admission, "I did it." But there were the most inculpatory aspects of it were when she would bring up earlier conversations. And for instance, she testified, and this is not a recorded conversation, this was an encounter that she had privately with him. She testified that he had admitted to her in early July to committing the murder. And then during the Vegas tape, she's talking to him about that. And it's his response to that is a non-denial, and statements like, "Well, what's to prevent you from going and telling all this to Skorlinski," and that sort of thing.
That's a point. In other words, even if there wasn't a tape, just asking, she could have testified.
She can still testify, and that's clear under the wall, at least under 968.31. Even if you assume that there is a violation of the wiretapping statute, her testimony remains admissible. Only the tapes are inadmissible. And so that is an important point. And so, ironically, even though there's 6 hours of tapes, they're more or less circumstantial evidence of guilt as opposed to direct evidence, but based on other testimony that she provided, other information that he knew about, and that sort of thing, and his conduct, too. There were some...
Mr. O'Brien, since the matter of the tape has been brought up, I was just looking at a portion of this transcript that your office provided, and it talks about the fact that it was a $27,000 editing bill and a note from Paulus to the editor saying, "I have replaced, modified, or added new excerpts to be included in the tape." There was also an editor's note that said, "Some of your clips are so short, 1.5 seconds in duration, that they may seem choppy." Is there any reason to believe that this tape that was shown to the jury was altered in an inappropriate way?
No.
That's a leading question to you. But
no, it's not. No.
How do you explain that? A $27,000 editing bill?
No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it takes to edit and transcribe. And, there was a separate version shown to the jury. My understanding was that there was one version shown to the jury and then a longer one shown during the trial. I don't know how that adds up to $27,000. I can tell you, though, that there's nothing to indicate any wrongdoing on anyone's part. After all, this is a videotape of Mr. Maloney's activities. If anyone knew what was going on and if anyone knew that the tapes were being messed with, he would be the one, and he would be able to tell his attorney, and there's no indication from either him or Mr. Boyle that anyone thought that those things represented anything less than what happened there.
Are you telling us that Mr. Boyle and the defendant had the full 6 hours worth of tapes so they could compare that with his recollection and compare that with the edited version?
That's my understanding, and I believe they also had the transcripts.
Full 6 hours?
I believe that's correct. In fact, I think that, this was the course of a weekend, so there was actually even more than that, but it was, my understanding is that it was narrowed down to 6 hours, and then that was what was used at trial, and then, this was all done pre-trial, and...
So they had the complete, unedited version.
See, one problem I have with this is something that's never been litigated up till now. I mean, these are issues that are extraneous to all this. I mean, the what happened with these tapes? I mean, this hasn't been a subject of any claim on either the direct appeal or the collateral appeal up till now, and it's a little. So I'm in some sense, in some ways, I'm guessing at what happened, or I'm surmising. I have partial knowledge, but I can categorically tell you that my understanding of this is that there was nothing out of the ordinary here, that this was, as in any case where you have undercover audio and video surveillance, you have tapes that are edited, that are transcribed, that are shortened, and that sort of thing, but that there was no indication whatsoever that anyone deleted critical information, exculpatory information, or added inculpatory information, anything along those lines. And that's, again, that goes far afield from the issues that we have here, which is whether there was a violation of the electronic surveillance statute or whether there should have been a contact with Mr. Maloney after he had retained Mr. Boyle. And, maybe the subject of further litigation. I don't know. That's up to Mr. Maloney's counsel. But at this point, there's no evidence to indicate that anything improper was done.
Is the bottom line of your electronic surveillance law violation argument that there was consent on her part, regardless if she was operating under color of state law or she wasn't? That is, regardless of what subsection you might come under in that law, that she operated with consent?
Yes, I think that really is, that she knowingly allowed it to be taped, and that is the beginning or end of it. Now, this whole injurious act, the law on that point is pretty clear that just coming up with damaging evidence could not be what tantamount to an injurious act. Otherwise, again, we would eliminate all sorts of, virtually all undercover investigative activities. My understanding of the law is that contemplates something criminal, something tortious, where it directed not for the benefit of law enforcement, but directed at that individual to harm that individual, and that. And so that section just doesn't apply. So if that injurious act provision doesn't apply, then her consent is the beginning and the end of the matter. If she consented, then that's okay. Then police are authorized to intercept it. And of course, then you have the threshold question of whether she was operating under color of law, and the defense position has changed 180 degrees. At the beginning, before trial, they said, yes, she was, and now they're saying that she was not. But again, regardless, her consent trumps all that and makes the determination of that question really unnecessary. Briefly with respect to the last issue, again, we're dealing with the Strickland v. Washington analysis, and with respect to the cross-examination and the strategy Mr. Boyle chose to try to attack the nature of the investigation rather than the character of the investigator, he chose a specific strategy that, in hindsight someone might question, but under Strickland you simply can't. It was a reasonable strategic decision and can't be second-guessed on review.
What exactly was his strategy?
To point out that the investigators made up their mind too quickly that Mr. Maloney was the suspect. To say, you don't believe, basically to say, you didn't believe this, you basically don't believe anything my client says, and you haven't even considered other suspects. You made up your mind too quickly. That was the thrust of that cross-examination, that they were biased. And rather than try to paint the investigator as a bad person or as an incompetent, to say that their focus narrowed too quickly. And that really was the whole thrust of all that. And to attack the credibility of the investigation rather than of the investigator. And
Mr. O'Brien, you indicated earlier regarding the right to counsel, and I think correctly, that Miranda does not apply here. I'm wondering about your response to this, however. When you have a situation where a person is a suspect and known suspect of a criminal offense who takes the step of retaining counsel and taking the additional step of having that counsel communicate that he is represented to the district attorney, understanding that Miranda may not apply, Why does that not constitute an invocation of the privilege against self-incrimination?
Well, but then you could do that. You know, again, that gets back to my example, the drug dealer sending letters around. I don't see much of a difference there. He's invoking counsel, but it's detached from any constitutional right. It's not a custodial situation, and it's a pre-indictment or pre-charging.
I concede Miranda is not at all applicable here. The question is whether or not you have to have custody to invoke the privilege, or can the privilege be invoked separately?
See, I don't think it can, because then an unrepresented person could do the same thing and thwart a criminal investigation. An unrepresented person who knows he's being represented knows he's being investigated could just send a letter to the DA saying, I can't afford one yet, but I'm invoking my right to counsel, or I'm going to hire one next week, so quit your investigation, or something. I mean, I can just see a situation where that could really create problems, and that, you know, unless it's attached to a specific protection, because he's not being questioned in that situation. I mean, he's being investigated. I mean, if he's being questioned by the officer, and he says, you know, I don't have an attorney, but I don't want to talk to you, then, you know, now we get into some of the old cases. I know, Fensel, I think some of the old ones that deal with that straight Fifth Amendment protection, and I'm not even sure that all the federal courts agree that that's a valid invocation, but I think that might be a situation where you could argue that that's, if he's being questioned. But, you know, in this situation, he's just being investigated. And I know of no law that you can thwart an investigation by invoking a Fifth Amendment.
What's the difference between being questioned and investigated? She's asking questions, and we have agreed that she's a police agent.
Well, first of all, I don't know that we've agreed that she's a police agent. In fact, they're arguing that she's not.
But you say she's working with them. She gets immunity. She's going in there for a purpose. If that isn't a police agent, what is?
Well, you know, that's interesting because that was the very argument Mr. Boyle made on the first appeal, and that didn't fly. You know, that you get into the State v. Lee cases and whether she's a stalking horse and that sort of thing. You know, and there are a whole number of factors you look at in that analysis that, that I just don't think apply in this situation where you really have two equal people who know each other and there's no deception. The only deception is that there's a camera in the room. Otherwise, everything they're talking about is
a minor.
Well, right, but I mean, this isn't someone who's changing their identity or acting as a police officer acting as a prostitute or something along those lines. I mean, this is a friend with a friend.
This is a living girlfriend acting for the police.
Yeah, she's young. And that's, but that.
This is similar to State versus Collins, then, right? Where the mother was acting as an agent for the police.
I'm trying to recall the one I recall is Lee, and that was where there was an agent for the police. But again, this was an issue that was litigated on the direct appeal and not reasserted here, and really has nothing to do with whether there's an ethical violation here or a violation of the wiretap statute, right?
Mr. O'Brien, did the AG's office or the district attorney's office explore any, if not all, the cases that Mr. Paulus handled or his office handled to determine whether there were any problems with them?
I know that our office did some investigation, including this case. I can't really speak to the extent of it. I certainly wasn't involved in anything outside of this case. So that
Were you advised of the result of that investigation?
The Meyer report, which was also referred to in that.
Right.
When it came out. Pardon me?
The result of that investigation was
the result of the question was whether or not this was a homicide, not whether or not Mr. Maloney was guilty, but whether this was a homicide or an accidental death, and the result of the report was that this was a homicide, and that was, it was left at that. you know, if, and Mr. Hollis's problems are well documented. We're looking at what happened in this case. Was there an ethical violation? Was there a violation of the wiretap statute? And, you know, I see nothing in this case that you can question the integrity of the outcome based on things that he did during the investigative stage.
Just to get back to your other argument, is this an outcome determinative test?
Well, since it's Strickland, no, now we're in the undermines confidence aspect. But to find prejudice, you have to show a reasonable probability of a different outcome. So,
but it's undermined confidence.
But it's undermined
confidence.
Same
words, reasonable probability.
Right. And I would say that there's nothing in the allegations presented by the defense here that would undermine confidence in the outcome.
You're not willing to talk, think that there's a problem in any number of cases that involve Mr. Paulus just by the fact that he was involved. That doesn't undermine confidence. I mean, that's really the elephant sitting in this room that we're not talking about.
Well, you know, I would suggest, you know, to look at the arguments that are being presented and substitute the name E. Michael McCann for Joe Paulus, for example, and see what results.
That you're saying is irrelevant.
Yes. And it should also be kept in mind that, yes, Mr. Paulus was engaged in a lot of misconduct, but it was many petty type, you know, the sort of the traffic sort of case. You know, it's a pretty big step to say that he would also undermine his own murder, the prosecution of a murder case that he is handling. And I have seen nothing at this point to indicate that anything untoward occurred in this case that occurred at all, or anything that would do anything to affect the fairness of this trial.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you.
Mr. Wasserman?
Again, may it please the Court. Mr. O'Brien has just told you that Joe Paulus was just engaged in bribery. Why would he undermine a homicide prosecution going out at the same time that he was engaged in bribery? Are you willing to take that risk?
Counselor, I want to ask you a little bit of question about the standard of care that's required when you're alleging ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
My understanding of reading of the cases is that you're not required to provide counsel that is the best possible, the most stellar counsel that could be provided to a particular defendant in order to meet the standard that adequate representation was provided, correct?
Correct.
And if I understand your argument that you made in the first part of your presentation, there are two lines of cases here, the Hamad line that you would like us to go along with and the line of cases from other jurisdictions cited by opposing counsel. And those two lines of cases come to conflicting conclusions. One, the Hamad case, that for an ethical violation that you should suppress the evidence. The other line of cases that you should not. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so if you don't need the most stellar counsel, and the question is still an open question in Wisconsin, how can you win on a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel because you've got a question that nobody yet knows the answer to?
Number one, as you pointed out, Your Honor, there was no case in Wisconsin that said we're not going to adopt Hamad. The ethics opinions clearly have already adopted Hamad. The one case cited by Boyle as his reason for not bringing the motion, in fact, is a Hamad line case. And the final reason was that if you read every case there is to read, again, this is the most egregious violation you could ever read about. No prosecutor went as far as Joe Paulus did. And maybe one more reason, and that is Attorney Boyle did complain repeatedly about that conduct. But again, the argument was undeveloped and without citation to the authority that was there. Then we would have been here on direct appeal. So yes, I understand we're here on ineffective assistance. There's a couple of things that I would really like to address. Let me do this. Mr. O'Brien says that because Tracy Hellenbrand consented, that's the end of the issue. That is true. If she's acting under color of law, under 968.31 sub 2 sub b, if she's acting under color of law, then the consent doesn't matter. But if she's not operating under color of law or acting under color of law, under sub C, which is what I believe must have and should have been argued, and no reason not to, no strategy not to, then the state has conceded that she was acting with intent to injure Maloney. And Mr. Bryan says that just going out to get a confession is not enough. That's only true under sub B. All the cases under sub C indicate if you're not acting under color of law and you're going out to get a confession under somebody, that's enough to suppress. I think
the state's position is that it makes no difference. But they're saying under C, if I understand their argument, that the tapes would be admissible anyway. So I don't think that. Yes.
But they're wrong.
Oh, they're
because
okay. No, I was just indicate you're saying they're wrong.
Absolutely.
On that issue.
Wrong as yes, under the statute, under the language of the statute, U.S. Supreme Court interpretations, it's all in my brief. If she's not acting under color of law, and mind you, when you read everything else that the state has given to you about Tracy Hallenbrand, what do they always say? Oh, she was acting on her own. She was formulating all the questions. We couldn't control her. Skolinski told her not to have sex with Maloney. She'd do it anyway. On the one hand, they say, well, she was kind of this rogue agent that we can't even barely keep her under control. Then they turn around and say, well, we're perfectly content with the idea that she was our agent. So they kind of want to have it both ways. Judge Nasi found she was not acting as an agent. They have never challenged that finding from the trial court. That's why in this 97406 motion, I'm alleging that it should have been argued in the alternative because it would have been successful. Mr. O'Brien indicates that, once again, international drug dealers are going to have a heyday if you support Maloney's position in this case. We know that that's not true. We know that all the cases on both sides of Hamad say if a lawyer is retained just to avoid being investigated, then Rule 4.2 will not apply, and he knows that, and every case that has visited that issue comes to that conclusion as well. And then that lawyer can join his client at Oxford. And that's what the cases all say. So I'm perfectly content with an exception for incidental contact.
Mr. Wasserman, what about Mr. O'Brien's position that 4.2 doesn't apply because there's no pending matter?
Thank you. May I answer because my time is up?
Yes. Go ahead, Mr. Wasserman.
The comment to the rule that you have issued says that there's a broad definition of party. It's any represented person or party. So he's ignored that, and I don't know if they've ignored that throughout their filings. The comment of the rule alone makes that point. In the Acosta case, Judge Edelman made that point when he was analyzing Wisconsin's Supreme Court rules on the conduct of prosecutors. That's cited in the brief as well. And that's just a red herring. The fact that he wasn't any, by the way, he was a party to at least one action, the disciplinary action, and everything that Tracy Hallenbrand did in terms of taping or talking to Mr. Maloney occurred after the June 8th meeting, after not only notice of representation by Mr. Boyle, but significant contact between Mr. Boyle and Mr. Paulus. Unless there's any more questions, my time is up. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserman, and thank you, Mr. O'Brien, for your arguments in 03-2180, State versus Maloney. That concludes our hearing on that case and concludes our hearings today in Fond du Lac. And again, let me thank all of the people in this community who made this sitting possible for the court, and we want to thank you all for coming. And now the procedure of the court is that we will leave, and we will go into our conference room, which is a jury room, and we will discuss and tentatively decide each of the cases we have heard today, and then a justice will be selected for each case for writing this decision. The justice is selected by Justice Wilcox selecting a poker chip, which has each justice's number on it. The justice who is in the majority and is selected and who hasn't already been selected for a case this month will write that case. And for those of you who wish to read the case, this decision, it will be posted on our website, and it will be posted on or before or around June 30th. So our website is wicourt.com.